right here is for the people.
Welcome guys to Renaissance Podcast 37. When we are unable to change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. This is one of the fantastic quotes from Viktor Frankl's epic book, Man's Search for Meaning. Another one of his great quotes from this book is, "Our greatest freedom is the freedom to choose our attitude in any given situation." Sounds like a very simple statement to make in any given situation. But with death and misery all around him, and imprisoned in Auschwitz during the Second World War, you know, possibly one of the worst prison camps ever, Viktor Frankl was able to survive a terrible experience. And all of this was by the power of his mind. His fantastic journey always makes me think of the amazing work being done by the Mind Body Awareness Project in California. This is a group that we've had on the podcast before. It's a fantastic group. It was founded in 2000 by Noah Levine. And these amazing people are dedicating their lives by actually going into the prisons and coaching the youth to develop tools and techniques akin to those expressed by Viktor Frankl. So as per the website, their mission is to help youth transform harmful behavior and lead meaningful lives through mindfulness, meditation, and emotional awareness. And today we're honored to have their executive director, Roger Miller, and also senior instructor and former guest, Micah Anderson. So guys, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Guy. We're glad to be here today.
Yeah, pleasure.
I'm also with co-host Anne Nguyen.
Hello, guys.
You missed out on the last podcast that we had with the Mind Body Awareness Project.
Yes, unfortunately. But I did hear the podcast and it was fantastic. So I'm very glad to be able to make it today and meet you guys at last.
And you are a college maths teacher in London and you...
I am indeed, yeah.
And you encourage your students to meditate, and that's...
That's right, yeah.
So, Micah, on the previous podcast, not to kind of go over the content that we spoke about before, but
sure.
One of the things that kind of stuck out to me was the difficult upbringing that you had, you know, at age 13, on drugs and alcohol, several different placements, cleaned up your act at the age of 16, you were heavily involved in a 12-step program. With the support of family and community, you were introduced to meditation, and that was kind of your journey into this world. So, Roger, I was wondering if you could perhaps, you know, introduce a bit about your background, how you got involved in the Mind Body Awareness Project.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And thanks for the brief introduction of Micah. Micah really embodies a lot of the work and the community that we like to serve. He came up out of some life challenges and then was able to work his way through them. And he brings that back to the youth in a really elegant and respectful and deeply humble way. I had to learn some of those lessons along the way in my life as well. How to be grounded in that way. But I came from a background of some privilege, growing up in the suburbs of Chicago, and I went to college and have worked in the nonprofit sector for the last 20 years. And a lot of the personality that I brought to a lot of that work was kind of a type A, aggressive, let's get stuff done kind of a guy. And that worked really well for getting some things done. But along the way, I certainly bruised some egos and burned some relationship bridges in ways that were just a little bit sad and unfortunate. And they didn't help me actually get as much of that stuff done that I wanted to get done. And I too have experience in 12-step recovery work. And I only got into that work because of hitting a bottom of my own. But that didn't happen until I was in my late 30s. And there, for me, some of the real catalyst was a physical illness a problem in my nervous system that just had me in massive amounts of excruciating pain. Taking morphine and Percocet to try and control that pain and thinking that I was going to be on lifelong chronic pain, that helped me boost my mindfulness practice. In addition to feeling like I was burning the relationship of my marriage, burning relationships in the job that I was in, because I was just a cranky, not very happy to work with person. And really, I look back with a lot of sadness on the way that I interacted with a lot of people during especially a lot of the 2000s, and feel like one of the saving graces of my life and one of the biggest and most beautiful life lessons was coming to have a bit more peace, a bit more ease by just, as you said, as Viktor Frankl did, learning to control my mind and my emotions just a little bit more, to be a little more measured, to be a little bit more grounded, to be able to drop in, to understand what's going on for me in this moment. Being able to do that has provided so much release and ease and peace. So I just joined the Mind Body Awareness Project as the executive director about a year ago. I feel really delighted to bring some of my now very deep and intensive daily meditation practice to some of the very deserving young people that we serve. It's a pleasure and honor to serve in this way, and I feel deeply blessed just to be doing this work alongside awesome folks like Micah and the rest of our instructor team who are doing it in the trenches every day.
Well, incredible journey. We spoke in early 2014, Micah.
Yeah.
And since then, I can imagine, because I've seen the rise of mindfulness meditation. I don't know if it's because now that I'm into it, you almost see it everywhere, in journals, magazines, online. So perhaps you guys, if you could just take some time to explain or to go through the, you know, some of the major events and some of the advancements of Mind Body Awareness Project since we last spoke.
Sure. Yeah. I'd be happy to kind of touch base on. You know, first and foremost, we're as Roger kind of pointed out, we're still very much, you know, in the trenches, the day to day classwork that's been continuing and blooming in terms of sites that we're at. We're currently in several county juvenile halls, detention facilities for youth, usually ages between, I'd say 14 and 18. Once in a while, we'll get a 19-year-old. So we're doing that, you know, close to every day a week, I'd say at least 5 days a week. Sometimes we have several classes in one day, different units. So we're still very much active in that. We're also continuing some work and increasing work in several public school systems around the Bay Area as well. So slightly different population, you know. These are people, kids who are, you know, just attending schools in various locations in Oakland and in other cities around the Bay Area. So that kind of stuff is still very much continuing and blooming. We've also, since we've last spoken, we have a new clinical supervisor who's been overseeing some clinical hours for myself and another member of the team, Kamal Ahmed. And both of us are in school currently for a psychology master's degree. Uh-huh. So in the state of California, it would be a license in marriage family therapist license. So we started to collect our practicum hours under the work we're doing at MBA. So since we've last spoken, that would be, you know, I would say in my estimation, the kind of biggest shift organizationally that we've had is a much more deepening of our clinical approach. We're looking at doing more and more research at some of the sites that we're located at, which we'd be happy to kind of talk about a bit more in detail at some point.
Sure.
So, and that's really been beautiful to see, because it's almost like, you know, you mentioned that, you know, just the kind of mindfulness and how it's been, seems like it's, you know, every time you just open the internet or you know, pick up a newspaper or a magazine, it's like we're in there. So I think very much like it's nice to for us to be taking it almost like to the next level, so to speak, in terms of like really involving research and a clinical, more of a clinical kind of mental health based approach to the practice. And I think it's will enable us to be, quite honestly, taken more seriously by a lot of these establishments. You know, it's like to a certain extent, we've always been kind of almost like a recreational thing. And I think there's an amount, you know, with data comes power, you know, so we're kind of now starting to look at being able to kind of offer research about like really the effectiveness of the, you know, the curriculum that we're teaching, the groups that we're running. And I'm really excited about that in the coming months and years for this organization.
Sorry, if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to just piggyback on some of what Micah just said. You aren't imagining something. There is mindfulness stuff cropping up everywhere these days.
Yeah.
It's really pretty exciting. It's been really fun to watch the number of just academic journal articles exploding. And if you want to use that as a proxy for we want to use the research work on mindfulness as a proxy for interest in mindfulness overall, that's one place where you just see absolutely exponential growth in research on mindfulness. Last year, there were over 700 academic journal articles that focused on some elements of mindfulness. If you look back 10 years, there were about 15.
Incredible.
That's a pretty good example of just how much interest there is, and it keeps on growing and growing. Micah was talking a little bit about some of our shift towards a mindfulness mental health model, and I'm really excited by the opportunities there. We've long been operating in what I would call a psychoeducational format. Psychoed is basically just teaching people about some of their emotions and about how they operate in the world, and it's a little bit about self-awareness, but mindfulness has really come in as a really great tool that can bridge the world of general human existence with the world of mental health. Mental health can often be quite stigmatized. Some people don't want to go to counseling or counselors or be poked or prodded at by psychologists. Many people have negative associations with that. And that is especially true in many of the youth populations that we serve. These young people have many very good reasons for mistrusting authority in all different shapes and forms, whether it's police or judges or their parents or teachers, all of whom tell them what they should be doing and how they should be changing their behavior. And of course, they're teenagers and they don't necessarily want to change their behavior. They want to be right, and they have plenty of reasons to want to be in a self-empowerment framework. That's the right time in their lives to do that. And a lot of what we try and do is we try and become that bridge from that world into the therapy and counseling world. And so a mindfulness mental health therapy, that's what we're working on developing right now and expanding in some of the ways that Jon Kabat-Zinn and some of other folks that you are interviewing are certainly working on as well. And we can help destigmatize mental health and make it okay, make it especially okay for this youth population to step into their feelings, especially because that can be a dangerous thing for them to do. Vulnerability can be a dangerous thing for them to do, especially inside places like juvenile halls and prisons, where vulnerability is not something that is honored and held up as being a core value, and being tough is.
That's very interesting. I think that's a very important point as well, that one of the questions I wanted to follow up was, so how do you go about sort of branding mindfulness, let's say, for the first time when you introduce it to a group of incarcerated youth, or how do you sell it, so to speak?
Yeah, sure. I mean, very carefully and very intentionally, you know, first and foremost, I think within, all of our classes in the hall are, you know, they're, first of all, for the most part, with some exceptions, but mostly they're not mandated classes. So that first and foremost helps out with the population that we're working with. You know, it's an open door. We try and get the youth to come, and we of course want them to stay. Yes. But if ultimately they don't find that the class or the techniques that we're offering are helpful, they're free to go. Okay. So that first and foremost helps, you know, with the population that we're working with, because the kids want to be in the room. Secondly, you know, we organizationally have an approach, several kind of attitudes that we try to embody when we go into the room.
Yeah.
The first, and we talked, I think probably Sam and I have touched base on some of these last thing, but I'll just kind of go over them again real quick. The first is just really tapping into our own authenticity.
Yes.
So just really showing up fully embodied, however we are in that moment. And I think that that's one thing that the youth don't get a taste of very often inside of a juvenile hall or a detention facility, and it's something that they respect and they end up ultimately kind of depending on and looking forward to.
Yes.
Second one is a really important one for me is kind of our stance on change. You know, basically, Mind Body Awareness Project, we go into juvenile halls really trying to keep our expectations in check. You know, we're there simply to build with the youth, to possibly offer some tools to self-awareness, but we're not there to tell them that they're bad people. We're not there to tell them that the lives that they're living are wrong.
Yeah.
And we're not there to tell them to stop quitting, you know, to quit their gangs or whatever, because as soon as we do that, we're aligning ourselves with a system that the youth already loathe, they already hate. You know, it's the teachers and the judges and the police and the parents and the staff, and, you know, a lot of times are often feeding them this narrative that they're a menace to society, and many times it ends up being self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, they start believing what they're told, and in a way we all could probably look at situations where we've done that in the past. I know I certainly can, you know.
Yeah.
So it's almost disarming. You know, there's this person kind of coming in and they're just like, hey man, we're not here to change you. We're here to just simply offer some techniques for self-awareness.
Yeah.
And that's very disarming for the youth. And I think that really allows us to get a foot in. Does that make sense?
Because,
you know what I mean? They're kind of like, okay, let's check this out for a sec, you know?
Yes.
And just really going in and just being like, look, let's see if we can create a culture for an hour or an hour and a half in this class that's a little bit different from what you guys normally experience, you know? So I think those perspectives really help build bridges with the youth and then offer a kind of basic techniques, you know, for things like anger management, impulse control, helping every, you know, most youth in the hall will admittedly have some sort of problem with either anger management or impulse control, as well as, you know, just not being able to sleep well, being stressed out about their court case or whatever it might be. So you know, we come in and say, look, we may be able to offer some techniques that can help.
Yes.
Help some of those things, you know.
Yes. And it's that approach that you're not judging them, you're not here to tell them, as you said, pretty much what they've been hearing all their lives from, whether it be the teachers or the judges, it's all the same. And it's interesting, I was reading, I don't know the latest statistics, but as we were doing a bit of research on reoffending rates in the US, it's something like 50% are reincarcerated within 3 years. And I was wondering if you guys have found any sort of success in prevention of further reoffending after a mindfulness course, or any sort of anecdotal evidence or any stories to tell with regards to that?
Yeah. Roger, you want to comment first on that?
Yeah. I think Michael would be really good for the stories. I can give you some statistics. So on a national basis in the United States, unfortunately, it's even higher than you postulated there. About 70 to 80% of youth are rearrested within 2 to 3 years, at least according to a study by Boston University.
70%.
70 to 80%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And 38 to 58%, depending on geography, are found guilty of new offenses within 2 years.
Wow.
And so their recidivism, you know, people coming back into this system, into a correctional system, at least one that is theoretically supposed to correct the behavior of young people.
Yeah.
This is obviously a system that is not doing that job very effectively.
Yeah.
It's kind of fundamentally broken in that way.
Yeah.
And so that's why from a lot of the more progressive thinking organizations, there is a lot of interest in trying to figure out how do we do something new, something different, something that might actually keep these youth from coming back into our facilities.
Yeah.
And you're seeing that across the board, right? You know, even folks as diverse as the far left of the political spectrum in the United States, the far right are coming together on those kinds of issues, and there aren't lots of issues in which they all come together on anymore. And so that's encouraging to see that there's a lot of work being done there. So in terms of the reduction of recidivism rates and reduction of those kinds of things, there are some very fledgling studies that are being done both with youth populations and with adult populations, but they're in terms of mindfulness work within prison populations. But nobody has good data on that yet. Even the sort of the biggest prison-oriented mindfulness organizations that are out there, like Prison Mindfulness Institute based out of Rhode Island, they don't have the funding yet to really fully ascertain what the recidivism rate is, what the return into those penal institutions are. And there are just now starting to be some major academic institutions that are starting to look at and want to try and do that work. We're just gearing up right now for a study that will happen next year with Syracuse University to do both a study on the training of the staff, and then also we'll be looking at return rates of youth.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, these are long-term studies, and long-term studies require big chunks of cash. And in order to be respectable, they also require it to be conducted by outside entities like major universities in an independent way.
Yeah.
And so we haven't had the funding for that yet. We are working on trying to build those relationships and are working a lot with the University of California and starting to work with Stanford on trying to develop some of those relationships to make some of those studies happen. But they aren't slam dunk kinds of things. You can't do it easily or quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The things that we have studied a lot of are what our impacts on the actual young people are. And we have done a pretty good job of documenting the reductions that our programs are able to make in anger and in a couple of other key impulse control and so a more effective impulse control. We are certainly starting to look at some new measures as well. We're starting to look at self-acceptance and self-compassion. So these are pro-social measures as opposed to only looking at a lot of the deficit-based approaches like looking at anger and low self-esteem, etc. So we're able to document some of improvements in those areas. And that's improvements in those areas as the youth go through our programs. But then obviously once those youth leave our programs, they go back out into the community and they sometimes meet up with some of the same life challenges that they had before they came into our program. Mm-hmm. I'd love to have Micah talk a little bit more about some stories of some of the what has happened with some of the youth that we have worked with, though, and I think that will probably be helpful as well.
Sure. Do you guys want to kind of follow up with any thoughts about what Ross said? Kind of detailed questions towards that.
So, I mean, I was just going to comment briefly that obviously your own personal stories were, I think, an inspiration, with the backgrounds that you've had. But yes, just to hear some of the stories that you've experienced yourself as an instructor, and because it must be very rewarding to see, even if it's one life that you've changed, even if it's one, I think it's worth the effort. For example, if I can briefly give you a story of my own experience teaching mindfulness to a student of mine, and I introduce mindfulness to them just in the context of how to help deal with stress in the exams. So just as, again, it's gently introducing them to the idea that there is a technique that you could perhaps use. So we were very careful when we introduced it to the classroom not to sort of try to impose it on them in any way, but, gently introduce them to an alternative method. And I got back a very touching email, which made it all worthwhile for me, just to summarize, he said how it's transformed his life. And that was just from a student who found studying for his exams tricky and stressful and a depressing time in his life. But I would imagine that someone, the kind of stories you guys would have heard would be very inspirational. Someone who's actually, let's face it, right at the depths of despair, when you've been incarcerated and you think to yourself, what options do I have in life? And so I'm keen to hear some of the inspirational stories.
Sure. Yeah. It's the work is, starting out and kind of reflecting what you said, the work is very rewarding at times, and it's also very, very challenging at other times, because there is this balance between, these breakthroughs that you see in the room that happen, and at the same time, the heartbreak or the, kind of checking my own expectations when a youth I had in class comes back through the doors after they got released, And so there's this balance between the two areas that as an instructor you really have to bring some real awareness to around gut checking, kind of like why am I doing it and what am I expecting and real intentions around going into the room. So along the lines similarly of what I talked about before, just that kind of stance on change or whatever, and that really helps from the perspective of the facilitator, not thinking that they're going to go in and change the world in one class or whatever, kind of keeping that in check. That said, there's so many kind of little gems and just these inspirational moments where you see the light bulb go on for, you know, for a 17-year-old youth. One, for example, I can think of, you know, I was doing a class, this is in one of the max units in a juvenile hall in the Bay Area, you know, and the max units are generally kind of the folks who are moving on to county facilities and then possibly even state or federal institutions after they do their time in the juvenile hall. So, you know, hate to say it this way, but it's kind of the worst that's in the hall in terms of the crimes that they've done and their sentence. And there was a young African-American male who I had for the first time in the group, and he was very, very open, heartfelt, you know, and you could tell in quite a bit of turmoil, just kind of internally, you know, and my training as a psychologist and you know, through MBA and in the hall for years is, you know, kind of allowed me to take note of that. And I led a short meditation for the group, and he was involved in it. And it was a small group that day, probably only a couple of kids. And afterwards, he kind of pulled me aside and asked to talk to me after the class, which is common, you know, if somebody wants to maybe process something that happened in the context of the group. And he kind of looked at me, you know, with this kind of amazed look. And we were sitting silently, and he was just kind of staring at me. He was like, man, I've had this knot in my chest since I can remember. And everybody in my life, the teachers and the staff and the police, and even my parents, even my mother, have always told me how to get rid of it, to do this or to do that, and nothing ever worked. And he said, right now, this is the first time that I can remember where that knot is gone.
Wow.
This knot in his chest. And he really pointed to his chest. Like, somatically, it was really profound, because he was talking about this tension that was a physical tension, obviously manifested in his body through years and years and years of, quite frankly, trauma. You know, that the majority of these youth that we serve, specifically ones that are coming from areas like Oakland and other cities in the Bay Area, where the amount of trauma that these people have witnessed in terms of physical violence against themselves, against their families, against their friends, living constantly in the threat of physical harm. It's literally like living in a war zone for these people. And the level of PTSD is relatively high. You know, I don't have stats to back that up right here and now, but just my own personal feeling about it, you know. So reaching a youth like that, in that small breakthrough, whether or not he comes back into a facility again, that's something that won't be taken away from him. So that's at MBA, we talk a lot about in our groups about planting seeds. That's very, very important. We plant these seeds of self-awareness that ultimately we don't have control over when or whether they bloom. Mm-hmm. We state that very clearly to the youth, you know, that it's like a plant, you know, it has to be fed and it has to be tended to. So just like a small breakthrough like that with the town, and that youth is now gone and in another facility, and you know, I think I might have even talked about it last podcast. I mean, real hard. Part of this work is that the majority of youth, we never see ever again, you know? So you have these little gems and these little beautiful, heartfelt moments with youth. All that to building relationships over the course of, sometimes I work with youth for a year or a year and a half. I could tell one other brief story about kind of the, you know, it would be a good segue. There were three youth actually in that same Max unit who had been coming to MBA classes for well over a year and a half, some of one even close to 2 years. He had been incarcerated in the same unit, same place, coming every Wednesday. And these youth, they'd been through the curriculum back and forth. They led the group. They helped model, you know, the group agreements such as, you know, confidentiality and authenticity and risk taking, even to the point where all three of them had actually lead meditations. And from the perspective of the facilitator, you know, in group process or group facilitation, this is like the sweet spot because the group is tending to itself. Yeah. Does that make sense? So
yeah,
it's like
absolutely.
This idea of like, you know, group governance. It's not like I kind of don't even need to be there. I'm just kind of once in a while directing it, but the group is like coming to the support of other people in the group. The group is leading the meditation. So we actually at MBA, you know, we grant, you know, these certificates once someone finishes the mindfulness-based curriculum, but we had to come up with a new certificate for these three young men because they had already gone through, the curriculum again and again and again. So we came up with this certificate entitled kind of junior facilitator.
Wow.
That we gave these three certificates to three of the youth and had a big party. We bought food in, and it was really sweet, a sweet moment, you know. So those are kind of two more on the inspirational side stories, you know, the last year that just kind of popped into my mind.
Oh, wow. Very inspirational.
We previously had a podcast guest, Danny Penman. He's a BBC journalist, also a best-selling author on mindfulness. He was paragliding in the Cotswolds, and it was only after a crash, he crash-landed. It's basically, his shins went through his knees. It was quite horrific. But while he was waiting for assistance, he recalled a meditation technique that he learned way back when he was in A-levels, college we call it here. But that got me thinking is that, you know, the lessons that you teach, you know, although may not necessarily resonate straight away, you know, I like the term that you use, planting a seed. Do you have any examples of people coming to you almost after the fact, you know, perhaps in a time of need later on where you almost have nothing left to try and in this state of pain where you apply these techniques?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, often, you know, often the techniques, you know, they land in the room, but it's like you said, I mean, it's like in the room, it's relatively easy to practice the techniques and that's the training ground for when we really need them. Like you pointed out, you know, in situations of stress or turmoil or anxiety, you know, so I've had plenty of youth tell me that whatever, they were sitting in the cell waiting to be sentenced at the court and they just kind of like dropped into their breath and it helped kind of, you know, bump that stress level down a notch or two or, you know, situations where maybe they were being kind of verbally threatened or kind of pushed by another person that they're incarcerated with and really didn't take the bait. We talk a lot about kind of impulse control, right? Because that's something that they want to see. That's something that places like juvenile halls they want clear results on. There's this idea of impulse control. So we talk a lot about the idea of price tags. So for example, you know, what's the price tag on? You wouldn't walk into a store and just purchase something without knowing the cost of it, right? You would check the price tag first. So we frame mindfulness in this regard with the youth. It's like, what's the price? Did you check the price tag before you did the action that got you incarcerated? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And this often lands really well with the youth. You know what I mean? Because it's like, yeah, I didn't check the price tag. It was kind of, you know, famous last words. It's like, screw it. Let's do it. You know? And then the next thing you know, you bought yourself 3 years of your life because it's, you weren't kind of thinking things through. So this often lands with the youth. And again, like, you know, often NBA, like, we're not there when they're released. And that's why this idea of just, like, hope and planting seeds that, like, this seed will bloom later on. Who knows when, whether mm-hmm. it's going to be 6 months or a year or three years or 6 years. At some point, these youth will be able to kind of call back to maybe some basic technique that they've learned in the room and remember it. Does that make sense? So it's often hard because we're not there, like, when they get released. And we don't have, at this point, any sort of kind of follow-up with the youth after incarceration, although there's, you know, there's an increasing kind of push, I think, organizationally for us to look at some sort of aftercare and some sort of support mechanisms that we could put in place for some of the youth after they get released, and we can talk a bit about that later.
No, that's fascinating. And one thing that leads me to think of is, I guess you guys are almost spiritual teachers in a way. And one thing that I was listening to a talk that Eckhart Tolle gave, it was a YouTube video that I found. If you don't know him, he's, you know, he wrote the Power of Now, an amazing guy.
I think we're both big fans.
Yeah. Well,
sure. we would imagine that you were. I think Guy was referring to the general audience.
The general audience, right. But,
sorry.
But he, what I love about it is that, you know, when you undergo a normal teaching, you're learning something new. But when you're referring to, he says that when, as far as mindfulness is concerned, and you being that almost spiritual teacher, you're almost helping these guys to reveal what is already there, so that it becomes so almost so clear that it feels like it's something that they knew they had deep down all along. Is that something that resonates with you? Is that something that you can relate to?
Very much so. One of our taglines, our mission statement, is actually to awaken the intrinsic value within the youth that we work with.
Wow.
And that's,
wow.
We're not there to teach them or give them something from on high. We are there to help them awaken what is already there within their bodies, their minds, their souls.
Yes.
There is deep richness there, and we're just there to help them tap into it in sometimes a very beautiful and very effective way.
Yeah.
If I may, I'd love to just jump back to a couple of the things that that Michael was talking about the reaching youth on the outside. Some of the new programs that we're developing are within some of the schools that are specifically for youth that are returning from juvenile halls out into the mainstream world.
Mm-hmm.
So almost all of our school-based programs are in alternative education schools. So those are schools for young people who haven't managed to succeed in mainstream education. And some of those youth are either transitioning into or out of juvenile hall facilities. But we're just launching a program now with the Alameda County Office of Education at one of their schools that is specifically for young people coming out of juvenile hall. And so that'll be working with a lot of the same youth population that we're working with inside the juvenile hall.
Excellent.
In that
Excellent.
County.
Wow.
And another, like, some of the long-term, more exciting projects that we're working on developing that we think will have some impact for the youth that we're able to work with who are connected to that particular school or other youth in general, is a program to develop essentially some app and some other digital media that we can be sending to the young people on a regular basis. So we can't always be there with them in every moment of stress, anxiety, or challenge that are going to happen in their days and lives once they're released from incarceration.
Yes.
But they are all likely to be carrying some kind of smartphone device. It is an increasingly part of all human existence in the Western world.
Yeah.
And those devices can be objects of mass distraction, or they can be objects of aid in helping us find a little bit more peace and serenity and ease and joy in our days.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working on developing content that we would be delivering to the youth via their phone devices, and have a program that would have a system of integrated texts and other reminders that would help them ground themselves throughout their day.
Right.
Now, there's a lot of this kind of thing that's in development all over the tech space.
Yeah.
There are some applications that have been proven and have proven to work well. But not necessarily for this particular youth audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the things that we'll be doing that will be slightly different than some of those other programs is to make sure that some of the content is really delivered in a youth voice, and some of the content that we'll be putting out there will come from their vantage point and speak to into their cultural lens.
Yeah.
And then we'll be trying to integrate that with, you know, a lot of other just regular content that will come to them on a regular basis. Even just as a for example, text-based programs have been proven to help reduce both STD prevention and had a little bit of nascent success in the realm of diet control and obesity prevention.
Mm-hmm.
And so giving people little reminders throughout their day to essentially be mindful has helped them to remember to do things like use condoms and to not overeat. Yeah. So we can use some of the learnings in that space for other forms of mindfulness, which for impulse control, anger management, and for making good life choices. And so those are some of the ways that on a long-term basis, we're going to be developing programs and products that will be able to serve the youth once they return to the community.
Yeah. I think there's almost a lack of that at the moment. And it's very inspiring to hear that, you know, you guys are at the forefront of developing the technology for that particular market. Funny you should say that, because we're actually in the process of developing our own app. Along the lines of guided meditations, and a question that we wanted, being cognizant of the time and how much time that we have left. But as far as guided meditations are concerned, do you have any advice and perhaps your thoughts on what makes for a good guided meditation?
What makes for a good guided meditation one, being grounded in your own body, your own self. And, you know, a lot of the words that you could use could be almost random. But if they're coming from a place of heart and a place of connectedness with yourself and a place of connectedness with the audience that you're speaking into, that goes a long way.
Wow.
Micah, you've got other thoughts, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's at this point, you know, in the mindfulness meditation world, whether it's secular mindfulness or more Buddhist kind of based meditation, it's, you know, there's so many different led meditations and styles of meditations. You know, there's mindfulness based ones, body based ones, love, kindness, compassion, forgiveness. I mean, the list goes on and on. So for myself, I mean, I find I stick with people who I know what they're doing, and I stick with people who I trust, and I stick with people who I know I resonate with, and I feel you know, like Roger talked about the heart. I mean, that's the most important thing. You know, even sometimes, you know, I just don't like the sound of somebody's voice. Or it could be that simple, or it could be the choice of words that they use. So there's the style that they lead, you know, so there's so many variables in that, you know. But I think for myself, it's someone who's got a combination of a deep understanding, authenticity, compassion, and experience to do it, you know, which is important with the amount of mindfulness being taught that, you know, I know for myself, being connected with teachers and with a lineage that goes back is something that's important to me personally. Yeah, so those were just a couple of thoughts about that. Mm-hmm. We could have probably an hour alone just talking about that, you know, itself.
Yeah, well, Michael, on the last podcast, you briefly touched on the word vipassana.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll have time to go into that today, but that's something that's really intrigued me recently, you know, and I'd love for you and I to perhaps go into that a bit deeper on another day. But one couple of questions I'd like to end the podcast on is, you know, if you both could speak with a mindfulness guru, you know, take a John Kabat-Zinn or the Dalai Lama, what question would you ask them and what would you want to know?
Well, thankfully, John Kabat-Zinn is on our advisory board, so yep. we have the honor of being able to communicate with him. Just chatting with him some in January. I have never had the pleasure of speaking with the Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. And I think that if I were to ask the Dalai Lama any one question,
it's tricky.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of questions that I would want to ask him.
Yeah.
I know so much about how my body generates suffering for me. Mm. I know about the process. I know about it intellectually. I know about it from from the physiological standpoint. I know about it from how it's generated, what my triggers are, and I know that I am capable of alleviating that suffering fairly easily. And I even know that I am capable of letting go of that suffering once the wheel has already started turning. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'm not capable of starting the wheel from turning. And in my best moments, I'm able to, of course, let go of that attachment to making that suffer, you know, to making myself wrong for suffering. But I think that my question for the Dalai Lama would be, how do I have the most peace? How do I make sure that I'm the most tapped in when that thing starts, when the wheel starts turning? How do I gently set that down the most effectively?
Yeah. Wow. And Michael?
It's really a tough one. You know, it's like, I'm not even sure of a direct question, but I would ask advice around fatigue, self-care, and burnout in this work, in within the context of service work.
Sure.
Because that's really real for me, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Because it's like, I'm going in day after day, week after week, and it's like, yes, we have these wonderful stories of inspiration, but it's also, there's the reality of what it looks like on the ground day after day, practicing it. And so I would ask advice around like compassion fatigue and this idea of just like, wow, man, I'm really burnt. What can I do? You know what I mean? And I think I'm always looking and open to new advice around that. And I think as a facilitator and a therapist in training, this has to be always at the forefront of my my consciousness and my understanding and my attentions is around, yeah, where am I at? You know what I mean? Like, and ultimately, is that not embodying what we teach? It's like coming back to ourselves and like that first line of intervention, that first line of defense, and that first line of opening and compassion is where it's within myself.
Yep.
So I think, yeah, that's kind of where I would lead maybe a question or a discussion in that direction.
Powerful, very powerful stuff.
I just wanted to end on a comment, actually, if I may, before we go. Just what an inspiration it has been hearing what you guys have done, you know, day in, day out, in often challenging situations. And Guy and I often discuss sort of, I mean, touching on the philosophy of life, if you like, on how one should live and what is our purpose, you know, what should we do with our lives?
Sure.
And I think what you guys are doing, I think, is a tremendous, I can't think of...
Epitomises it, really.
Epitomises, because I think there's not that many other sort of professions or way of living that I could look at in a moral sense and say, wow, these guys are contributing to the greater good of society. And when you plant those seeds, even if, as I say, even if it's one or two, or you are giving them, I think, the greatest gift, which is you're giving them something that could forever change their lives. So if I give someone a bit of money, it's how they spend that money. It will come, it will go. And obviously, you know, in our world today, that's much easier appreciated, right?
Here's, teach a man to fish, that
yeah,
kind of,
that
yeah.
Teach, exactly, yeah. You know, yeah. Exactly that sort of Chinese proverb, you know. And so you guys have given them the net, something, that the tool that could transform lives forever. And I think that is incredibly inspirational,
mm-hmm.
To hear these stories. And I think Guy and I can very much relate to this continuing struggle. And whether we change one, two, tens, hundreds, thousands, whatever, I think it's on the right side of this continuing struggle to contribute in some way. And I think if you reflect on life at the end of your journey, I think there is no better way to choose to live. So thank you very much for your contribution.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say that as far as all the roles that you could play in a mindfulness way,
yeah,
I mean, hats off to you guys. You probably have the hardest job in the business.
Mm,
you know, I mean,
the
front lines, exactly. So if you want to find out more, I mean, visit the Mind Body Awareness Project online. It's go to mbaproject.org. There's a fascinating tab there under the research. It shows some of the research that this group's doing that's, you know, leading the way in helping the rest of the world understand, you know, what is successful, what is not, what are the best techniques. I mean, even John Kabat-Zinn refers to the mind-body awareness, you know, you've created this language, you know, and this is a language that's being appreciated and understood by your target audience, and people are learning from you. So visit that. There's also the I know you guys are on Twitter. Check out the Mind Body at MBA Project. You know, hit these guys up. Show your support. Show your love. Because I mean, this, you know, as far as Anne and I are concerned, and Team Renaissance, you know, we've been following your progress and just been loving the way that you guys are not only leading the way but providing everyone else with information and guidance on how we, and as you as a teacher,
yep,
myself as a podcaster, and how to help spread this very important message.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Guy and Fran. We feel very honored to do the work that we do. It definitely is, as you know, in the Buddhist principles of the Eightfold Path, we definitely do feel honored to be to feel like we're in line with right livelihood as a means of both supporting ourselves in the world and supporting the world. And we feel honored to do the work that we do with the youth that we serve. They are our teachers in a great many ways, and we are doing our best to try and learn from them as much as we're teaching anything to them, for sure. And one other final thing that I'll just say is, you're right, we are on the front lines, and the front lines are sometimes challenging places to be. And you're also right that there's a lot of mindfulness out there for a lot of different populations. There isn't a lot of funding for the youth that we do within the populations that we serve. So if anybody does want to support the Mind Body Awareness Project with a donation, you can also certainly do that at mbaproject.org. And thank you for your time, Guy and Fran. We feel honored to be on this podcast.
No problem. We will put up the links to access the research, you know, the donate button, etc. We'll put it all up. And guys, man, you really need to support this organization. So Roger, Micah, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. We've learned so much, and good luck for your ventures and for the rest of 2015.
Yeah, thank you guys. We're really appreciative of being back on the program, and look forward to, you know, always having another conversation with you folks.
Great stuff. Great. Thank you.
Cheers, guys. Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
All right. So, great podcast, guys.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Great podcast.
And I'd say, Guy, like, if you're ever interested in doing, like, do you guys do, like, light meditation or anything like that? Like,
yeah.
Podcasts of, like, guided meditations, I'd be happy to do one, or, you know, get some.
Perfect. We are definitely going to take you up on that, because, you know, last time you spoke of the dog, you know, the dog versus the lion mind, that's been something that we lead a lot of, you know, when we take our friends out and we try and like explain a bit about, I guess, in the easiest possible way without being too intrusive or too, I love that. So yeah, we will definitely take you up on that.
Yeah. Just hit me up on whatever I can do to help.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So what I'll do is I'll throw in some music. I'll make some edits, cut out, you know, some whatever needs to be cut out. I'll send you guys a copy.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do a write-up for it as well. And then let me know your thoughts on it. You know, if you want me to remove anything or, you know, whatever the case may be.
Cool.
Until you're satisfied with it. And then once we're both satisfied with the quality and the content, then we can throw it out. Usually with a conversation like this, you know, I hardly edit out anything because, you know, this is, you know, just the general flow of a conversation. That's the beauty of a podcast instead of a, you know, a radio show where you got 5 minutes and then an advertisement or something. This was just a flow of conversation.
Yeah, I mean, just for myself, there was nothing, I didn't have anything.
Yeah, if you could just edit out all of our likes and hums, that'd be great.
Tell me about it.
But yeah, I don't think there's anything specifically content-wise to be edited out. If you wanted to, you know, trim it, we definitely did duplicate some content from one.
No, but Micah, that's perfect. You know, some of the key points, they do need to be reiterated. You know, they do need to be repeated. So, you know, I will definitely not be taking those out. Those are the gems, as you mentioned.
Sure.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. And so, just so you know, Guy, I'm not sure if you do know this, but so Vipassana, you just asked about that in the context of the show. So Vipassana is one of the lineages of Buddhism. So it's a sort of Vipassana/Theravadan Buddhism. That's the kind of the school that came out of Burma and sort of southern Thailand. Sort of Southeastern Asia,
yep.
and it's one of the schools that, you know, has come over to the West.
Yes.
There's the Mahayana school, and there's you know, the Zen schools of the North that came up out of all the areas of Japan and Korea, and so Vipassana is just sort of one of the lineages,
right. But do you guys know Sam Harris or heard of his work?
No, heard of his work yet.
Because one very interesting thing that he mentioned to me was that he said, you know, mindfulness is the tool that you use. you know, the concentration on the breath. But he refers to Vipassana as the almost like the zone or the state of mind that you achieve, you know, through mindfulness. And it's almost like something very spiritual. I don't know how much truth there is to that. Is that how you understand it as well?
I think it would just depend on perception. I mean, think of mindfulness, the secular, modern-day secular mindfulness movement that MBA is kind of founded in is techniques that are borrowed from Vipassana. Does that make sense?
Yep, yep. Yeah.
Vipassana is often translated as insight meditation. Mm-hmm. So I think for some people there could be that connection with, kind of deeper, maybe a spiritual connection with the actual meditation. It's more than just about being here and now, but often, entering into the idea of truth or just witnessing truth mm-hmm. as it arises.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think easily someone could kind of make that stretch. And like you said in the podcast, I mean, it's like, ultimately, a lot of these, we're all spiritual beings on one level or another. Mm-hmm. Don't get me started.
We'll have to do a whole new podcast on that, because I think as you advance in mindfulness, I mean, Anne and I, last time we spoke, I hadn't meditated. And since then, I've done probably like 3 months of at least 5 meditations per week.
Very good. Good for you.
So the journey that I've been on has been very, very spiritual. And I'm not saying spiritual in the religious sense. I know as soon as you throw in the word spiritual, it gets kind of, you know, a lot of people that don't know much about mindfulness will get turned off, or they will think, you know, oh, this is a religious, or, you know, this is Buddhism in some shape or form. But, you know, just understanding about, you know, who I really am, who the ego is. And and then, you know, once you get past all that, you realize, you know, don't love your neighbor as if they were yourself. You know, I think Sam Harris says, love them because they are yourself. And that does get kind of spiritual. But you know, I don't care. I think I love the idea. And, you know, the fact that once you help someone else, the parts of the brain get lit up, the same as when, you know, the reward centers, when you help yourself.
Sure. Yeah.
And perhaps we can have another podcast where we perhaps take it to that next level, which is really what fascinates us.
Yeah, sure.
Great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, so Vipassana, you know, that's sort of that lineage. Some of the term, I'm not sure if this is what the Sam Harris was referring to, that one of the things, the terms out of the Vipassana space that I often refer to and use when to describe that that feeling of sort of deep grounded in my body connection is
yes.
Samadhi or Samadhi. But the interesting thing about our work is that these are all terms that come up out of the original Pali, that's the language that the Buddha spoke. And
yes.
We can use those words when we're talking to each other, when we're talking about our practice. We cannot use those words if we're going to be effective talking to the youth that we're serving. It just it becomes counterindicated. And so we have to sort of even step out of the language that we're using right now and step into what's gonna work with this young person that I'm talking to in this moment. So
yes.
It's sort of that's the game that we have to play. There's a lot of translation that we and especially Micah and our other instructors are doing on a regular ongoing basis.
It's been an honor, guys, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Sounds great. Sorry.
No, trust me, it's been well worth it. Alright guys, good night, thank you very much.
Some of the smartest dummies can't read the language of Egyptian mummies and a flag of a moon and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youths, cause it's not like the future depends on it. We'll save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee them a make big money. This is how the media pillages, on TV the picture is savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a car, keep pants, and all of a sudden you are say a Indiana Jones, and I tip out the gold and tip out the scrolls and even the bird bones. So Some of the worst paparazzis I've ever seen and ever known. With the worst on this place that the world can see, and that's all that we'll ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like it'll be at home. Get tricked by the beast, but the way them a go flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them still can't defeat and them could have never clone. A spiritual DNA that prints in my soul and I will forever own, Lord.